Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
In 1958, 12-year-old Jamie Hearman was the focus of significant psychokinetic disturbances at his family's home in the town of Seaford, Long Island. In total, the disturbances lasted for around 5 weeks, with multiple eyewitnesses and a wealth of inexplicable phenomena being recorded. The unexplained events in New York State became known as the Seaford Poltergeist Incident. With a total of 67 separate anomalous occurrences recorded by investigators over the course of the 5 week period, the experts, both professional and amateur, were stumped. Journalists from Newsday, Time Magazine, The New York Times, and the London Evening News visited the Hearman family home along with physicists, scientists, psychologists, and at least 3 members of law enforcement. None of the witnesses could provide any plausible explanation as to the causes of the incidents which happened inside the Long Island house. Some 20 years after the disturbances ended, the events in the house provided filmmaker Steven Spielberg with the basis and inspiration for his 1982 blockbuster titled Poltergeist, a fact that I'm very glad I didn't know as a young child. The Hearman family consisted of James and Lucille Hearman, and their children Lucille, aged 13, and James, aged 12. So, in regard to the daughter Lucille, we're going to refer to her as Lucy in this episode. Regarding the son, we're going to call him Jamie, just to alleviate any kind of confusion with their parents. The family lived at 1648 Redwood Path in Seaford, Long Island, a beautifully kept ranch-style home. The house had been built in 1953 and contained 3 bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchen, a small dining room, a living room, and a basement that was divided between a utility room and a playroom for the children. It was a typical 1950s era home in a quiet, conservative neighborhood with public parks and tree-lined streets. Fun fact, the house is just 4 miles away from the Amityville house. On February the 3rd, 1958, the first incidents occurred at around 3:30 p.m. Both of the children were at home with their mother, while their father was at work. Young Jamie had come home from school to find a ceramic doll and a model ship laying broken on his bedroom dresser. The items were arranged so that it looked like the doll had crashed into the ship. At around the same time, Lucille found a small holy water bottle on the dresser in her and her husband's room, positioned on its side, with its cap removed. The contents of the bottle had spilled out onto her dresser. From that point, over the next 2 hours until roughly 5:30 p.m, noises were heard throughout the house as 6 screw-top bottles opened, fallen over, and spilled out in 4 different rooms, all with nobody present or near the bottles. The substances in each of the bottles were nail polish remover, hydrogen peroxide, rubbing alcohol, liquid starch, and bleach. In one incident, a half-gallon bottle of bleach that had been on a shelf in a cupboard smashed onto the floor about 6 feet in front of where Jamie and his mother were standing. It's worth noting that there were no earthquakes or ground tremors recorded in the area on that day, nor was the family home on a busy road that saw much traffic. As Mr. Hearman later recalled at roughly 5 p.m. that day, quote,
"So I'm down at my office. My wife calls me and she says, 'James, what's going on here?' I say, 'How do I know? I'm 35 miles away. She says, 'All the bottles in the house are blowing their tops.'"
As nobody was hurt, and there wasn't any damage, James didn't think there was any reason to rush home early. Besides, he thought, I'm sure there was a simple explanation for what was happening back home. His wife was surely overreacting at something completely innocent and normal. Mr. Hearman got home at his usual time that evening at around 7 p.m. When his family explained to him what had been happening around the house, he initially suspected tricks or pranks were being played by Jamie. There weren't really any further unusual incidents for the next couple of days, until about the same time on the afternoon of Thursday, February the 6th. On this day, the same individuals were present within the house. Once again, another half dozen bottles in various locations around the house loudly popped their caps, with their contents spilling out. All of these bottles were screw caps and fully fastened. The next day was Friday, February the 7th. Again, at the same time in the afternoon, roughly 3:30 p.m., and with the same individuals in the house, more bottles popped open and jumped in their varied and respective locations. Then 2 days later, on Sunday, February the 9th, Mr. Herman, who was still thinking that his son was playing tricks, got to see the phenomenon firsthand. At around 11 a.m, when he was standing in the bathroom doorway, while his son Jamie was brushing his teeth, Mr. Herman gently quizzed Jamie about playing practical jokes. Eventually, he accused his son outright of being the culprit behind the recent happenings in the house. Jamie was annoyed at being accused, but before he could spit out his toothpaste and protest his innocence, a medicine bottle and shampoo bottle slid 18 inches across a shelf at the same time, in paths at right angles to each other, jumping off the shelf and landing at the feet of young Jamie. Even though Mr. Herman had witnessed this with his own eyes, he was still skeptical and quickly grabbed the bottles off the floor to examine them and the surrounding bathroom area. He was searching for hidden wires, strings, or anything like that, but he found absolutely nothing. The realization slowly sank in that perhaps there were things going on in the house that he could not explain. Mr. Herman stated that he really didn't know what to do at this point. More than anything else, he was confused as to what could possibly be happening. So he called the Nassau County Police Department and spent the next several minutes on the telephone with the desk officer, Lieutenant Frank Richardson, trying to get the lieutenant to take him seriously. When Richardson heard the story, he accused Herman of either playing a practical joke or of drinking too much. But what made him eventually believe Mr. Herman was the tone in his voice and his persistence. Mr. Herman was entirely serious, and his voice was shaking a little. He wasn't screwing around, Richardson later said, and it helped that Mr. Herman was not only a respected member of the community, with no record for making stupid calls to police, but he was also a reserve captain in the police department himself. Lieutenant Richardson promised to send someone over to investigate right away, although he admitted that he wasn't sure what the police could do in this situation. Officer James Hughes went to the house, and he too was skeptical, and wondering how he managed to end up with some kind of nutcase call. His words: "Bottles moving around on their own, popping their screw tops and spilling their contents everywhere. It all sounded like fantasy and mental illness," Hughes thought. But within just a few minutes of him being there, he started to believe it. He wasn't sure what he believed exactly, but he was sure that this was no prank. Patrolman Hughes had checked out the bathroom where the incident had just occurred, and was in the living room with the entire family, asking them questions, when more loud noises were heard coming from up in the bathroom. Bang, bang, bang. Hughes went along with the family members to investigate, and they found a number of bottles on their side with their contents sprayed all over the bathroom walls. Hughes later stated to independent investigators that he had inspected the bathroom just a few minutes prior to this occurrence, and all was entirely normal. Everyone who was in the house was downstairs, in the living room, with him. At this time, it had already been cleared up after the last disturbance. That was when the shampoo had crashed to the floor and the Kopek tape bottle had fallen into the sink and cracked the whole bottle. Hughes was convinced that the bottle was upright, solid, and on the shelf. He remembers seeing it. It was a distinct green colour. Hughes also said at the time, quote,
"Sir, I can swear to that. Absolutely. I am 100% clear and certain in my mind.
When further questioned, Hugh said that he could not exclude the possibility that someone had turned the bottle over after he had first seen the bathroom. But in this event, he could not account for the noise or the fact that everyone was with him downstairs. He wanted it to be a hoax. More than anything, he really wanted to catch the family out, Hugh said. But he just could not explain it. Later, in his police statement, Mr. Herman said, quote,
"At about 10:30 a.m., I was standing in the doorway of the bathroom. Suddenly, two bottles, which had been placed on the top of the vanity table, were seen to move seemingly on their own. One moved straight ahead slowly, while the second spun to the right at a 45-degree angle. The first one fell into the sink. The second one crashed to the floor. Now, both bottles moved at the same time. They must have become unscrewed while they were in the cabinet under the sink. I just know that they had been placed on the vanity top while the cabinet was being cleaned."
On February the 11th, Detective Joseph Tozzi of the Nassau County Police Department was assigned to full-time duty on the case. He interviewed all those who were in the house at the time of the disturbances, and also collated information about the disturbances that had happened prior to his arrival. He produced a thorough record detailing everything meticulously. On February the 13th, the occurrences extended to other objects such as porcelain and plastic figurines, which moved, collided, and flew as if they were thrown, sometimes smashing into pieces. Larger objects including lamps, a night table, a phonograph, a dresser, a coffee table, and a bookcase, which was upended and turned upside down. These objects were repeatedly targeted. A glass counterpiece was moved several times, and a desk was scratched and chipped by figurines being forcefully flung into them at different times. Noises were also noted throughout the house with increasing regularity. The noises would rumble and bang loudly throughout the house. They sounded like the walls were caving in and furniture and objects were being smashed with a hammer. That's how Lucille described it. On February the 15th, a relative of the family named Marie Murtha was visiting. She was sitting in the living room with the two children, her cousins, when she witnessed a figurine begin to wiggle, vibrating and rocking on the spot. In her words, she said, quote,
"I saw the figurine shaking for a short while, then it flew rapidly about 2 feet towards the family's television set. But it fell just a couple inches short of hitting it."
She added that it was such a loud noise that she was surprised it didn't break. Murtha, like all of the witnesses to the phenomena, was questioned by Detective Tozzi. She insisted that neither she nor the two children who were present with her had been anywhere close enough to the figurine to be able to touch it. So, during this 2 week span since everything had started, news about the strange events had leaked to the newspapers, to the radio, and television media. The story received a lot of publicity, even being covered in Time magazine and Life magazine. "And that's when the public attention started getting crazy," Mr. Herman said. During the day, the Herman home was surrounded by reporters, photographers, random, curious people or looky-loos, and an astounding array of television equipment. The Hermans managed to get used to these intrusions in their life, but they weren't quite prepared for some of the strangeness that came with everything. Letters arrived each day, phone calls at all hours and from all over the world. Many of them proposed logical solutions, while others accused the Hermans of conducting an elaborate hoax. Some people were kind, others were vicious and insulting. One letter told the Hermans that the disturbance was caused by Martians who had landed nearby. It was the 1950s, I suppose, although I'm not too sure that this would be any different today. An elderly gentleman called the house at 2 a.m. one night and warned the Hermans that the problem in the house was caused by a spirit of a long-dead Indian chief who was buried on the land that their house was built on. The Russians were tunneling under Long Island to invade New York, came another telephone warning. Again, it was the 1950s, I suppose. Many people calling were just screaming and shouting into the phone. Someone daubed the front door with red paint that exclaimed, "Repent or perish." The Hermans managed to stay patient with everything that was going on. They never turned anyone away, listening to every call and reading every letter. They were receiving roughly 25 letters a day on average. Many of those letters suggested that the family had invited tricks of Satan onto themselves. Ministers from all sorts of faiths started conducting rituals on the front lawn of the house. One man, who claimed to be a holy man, knelt in the yard and prayed for 10 minutes. Then he stood and loudly announced, quote,
"Peace, everything is all right now. You and all have been forgiven."
And with that, he left. The problem, however, did not go away. For the most part, the Hermans were pretty open to hearing anyone's opinion of what the phenomena might be, and any suggestions for assistance. But moving forward, on February the 20th, a series of incidents occurred in the Herman home. Detective Tozzi was in the living room speaking with Lucille. He had earlier deliberately placed a full sugar bowl near a corner of a table in the adjoining dining room. Young Jamie was doing homework at the end of said table, farthest from the bowl. All of a sudden, the bowl exploded and landed in the hall, spraying grains of sugar everywhere. It had covered the dining room and part of the hallway. That's when Detective Tozzi called his chief. He said that there was no doubt the incident had occurred, and that in his opinion, in view of the time and distance factors involved, no hand could have touched that bowl. When asked about it, young Jamie simply said, quote,
"I only heard the noise. I didn't see anything happen, though. It all happened far too quickly."
Two other incidents are described in the police record for that day, and they are as follows. On the same date, February 20th, at around 9:45 p.m., Lucille Herman was on the telephone in the dining room. James was right next to her, and Lucy was in her bedroom. Jamie was putting his books away, and there was a bottle of ink on the south side of the table. A very loud pop was heard, and the ink bottle lost its screw top, firing it high into the air. The bottle left the table in a northeasterly direction. It landed in the living room, and the ink spilled over a chair, over the floor, and on the wallpaper and the north side of the front door. Lucille, startled, immediately ended her phone call and dialed the police, who had just left the house only around 10 minutes prior to this happening. When the police officer returned, it was learned that as soon as Lucille had called, she had taken the two children with her into the hallway to await the arrival of the police. At around 9:50 p.m., while the children were with her, a loud thump was heard in the living room. All three of them went into the living room to investigate what the sound was and found a porcelain figurine had again left the end table and had flown through the air for about 10 feet and hit the desk, scratching the paintwork. On this occurrence, the only noise heard was when the figurine had hit the desk. And on occurrence, it had broken into a number of pieces and fell to the floor. The only appliance running in the house at this time was the oil burner, and again, no one was in the same room as it. Each of the three family members later corroborated their movements to investigators. The three were standing at the end of the hall near the bathroom, out of sight of the contents of the living room when they heard the crash. Lucille Herman was standing with her back to the linen closet. Jamie and Lucy were standing in front of the bathroom door. They were all facing one another. On February 23rd, 24th and 25th, David Kahn, a reporter from Newsday magazine, was allowed to sleep in the house overnight, and he witnessed multiple occurrences. These included the sound of a dresser falling over, which smashed a bottle of hair tonic which was placed upon it, and also the noise of a lamp being overturned in Mr. and Mrs. Herman's room. Both an independent investigator and a police sergeant named Bernard McConnell were the only two individuals upstairs when they witnessed two doors at the opposite end of the hallway slam shut and a light bulb explode in front of them. On February 24th, a physicist named Robert E. Zeder from Long Island's Brookhaven National Laboratory visited the home. He heard the sound of Jamie's bookcase being turned upside down and was also present when a picture was thrown off of his bedroom wall by an unknown force. Zeder brought a set of dowsing rods with him and went over the property. When he was finished, he stated that he believed there was underground streams below the house. He thought that the water might be creating a strange magnetic field. Robert Zeder, who was a technical specialist in high-energy particle acceleration, charted fields that he felt were caused by the water under the house. He related this to the presence, about a mile away, of a recharge or infiltration basin, which had been recently heavily coated with ice. Mr. Zeder felt that powerful vibrations, caused perhaps by a passing jet airplane, might have jolted the ice so hard that the shockwave was transmitted by the underground water streams in such fashion as to back up or strike hard directly under the Herman house. Now, I appreciate this may sound like a stretch, but it was a proposed theory. Detective Tozzi examined this idea at length, but a geological survey suggested that the information was inaccurate. The Hermans were open to any kind of logical solution for the most part, however. Then on the night of the 24th, Dave Kahn was alone in the living room at around 9 p.m. He was reading on a chair, chosen specifically by himself so that his eyes would be in a direct line of sight with Jamie's darkened bedroom. Suddenly, a 10-inch geographic globe, ordinarily on top of a metal rod at the far side of Jamie's bedroom, hurled itself across the hallway. It landed in the living room across from where Mr. Kahn was sat. The reporter rushed across the hall and flipped on the light in the boy's bedroom. The boy was sitting up in bed. His legs were still under the blankets. Jamie said that he had heard the noise, but not seen anything once again. Mr. Kahn wrote that it was possible, although improbable, that the boy had thrown the globe. The next day, on February 25th, a statuette of the Virgin Mary flew from a dresser top in the Herman's bedroom. Later that evening, with Jamie alone downstairs in the living room, doing homework on a table at the far side of the room, a portable phonograph at the other side of the room left its stand, flew across the room, and dented the wood of the openwork stairway. Jamie later said, once again, quote,
"I heard the noise again. It was really loud. But when I looked up, I just saw the pieces of the phonograph on the floor. It all happened too quickly to see. I couldn't react in time, I guess."
Obviously, the fact that Jamie had been alone in the room on several occasions and nearest to the displaced articles meant that the attention focused on him once again. Detective Tozzi agrees that it would have been possible for the boy to have caused some of the incidents, but he emphasized that it would have been improbable and in many instances downright impossible for him to have caused all of them. The detective specifically cites the overturning of a 75-pound bookcase shortly before the globe was thrown. It was far too heavy for Jamie to have moved it. A set of the Universal Standard Encyclopedias was also stacked upon the bookcase. Even a grown man would have had trouble turning that bookcase and its contents upside down, let alone a scrawny 12-year-old boy. News reports of the incident came to the attention of the Parapsychology Laboratory of Duke University, which is now known as the Rhine Research Center. That center assigned J. Gaither Pratt and William G. Roll to investigate. William Roll was a well-documented and respected parapsychologist. He has been involved in some very interesting cases. Anyway, on February 26th, Pratt visited the home, hoping to witness some of these disturbances. Like everyone else, Dr. Pratt was welcomed into the Herman residence and greeted very warmly. He explained that he had come purely as an observer, and he spent most of the time there just talking with Jamie, playing cards with him, helping him with his homework, and generally just being around the boy. There was no sign of anything out of the ordinary during this particular visit. It was Pratt who then contacted William Roll to join him at the residence. Together they interviewed the family members and were convinced that none of them were perpetrating any kind of hoax. Pratt told a United Press reporter that the family was much too shaken for it all to be a hoax. Absolutely nothing occurred while Pratt was there, and he left on March 1st. On March 2nd, the disturbances resumed. On March 4th, John Gold, a reporter from the London Evening News in the UK, visited the home. He saw and heard several incidents which he couldn't explain, at times when members of the family were in different rooms. On March 7th, Pratt and Rowe made a second, unpublicised week-long visit. During this visit, they both saw and heard a number of incidents. Two loud thumps from Jamie's room on March 9th, whilst Jamie wasn't even at home. And the last recorded incident involving a bleach bottle the following day, which would have been March 10th. Detective Tozzi stated that he was completely stumped. He had a briefcase full of data and evidence. He had consulted every kind of engineer imaginable. He had spent several hours interviewing the family on different occasions. He was also working closely with a parapsychologist from Duke University. He said that he was perplexed, but not discouraged. Throughout his entire investigation, Detective Tozzi was also mocked, ridiculed and laughed at by his colleagues, who saw his investigation as a wild goose chase. His colleagues felt that the Herman family was making a fool of Tozzi and pressured him to abandon the case. Regardless, Detective Tozzi stuck with the investigation. So, let's talk about the theories, shall we? In June 1958, a 45-page report by Pratt and Roll was published in the Journal of Parapsychology. It comprehensively logged and categorized the incidents and described the actions and statements of the people involved. It was thorough, detailed, and in-depth. It goes on to discuss physical causes, fraud, and paranormal psychological aberrations as potential explanations and some of the physical causes. Pratt and Roll noted that a variety of tests carried out by experts during the occurrences ruled out most physical causes. A neighbour with a radio transmitter was found not to have used it for several years, and tests showed no unusual radio waves were identified at the property, so this ruled out high-frequency radio waves in the area. Unusual ground movements were ruled out, and scientists detected nothing remarkable during the three disturbances that happened while they were present. No unusual ground movements were logged by a number of seismic monitoring stations in the state or on the seaboard region either. Police lab tests found no foreign or unexpected matter in the decap bottles. All electrical equipment was checked by electrical experts and found to be in good working order. No other malfunctions could be identified with any appliances, electrical systems, or equipment in or around the home. Further, downdrafts from a chimney could not have contributed to the occurrences, it was deduced, and there were no abnormal problems with air circulation within the home. Storm windows in the cellar were checked, to no avail, and a well near the house was checked, and there have been no change in the previous 5 years in relation to groundwater levels or movements. In fact, these checks identified that the house had not been built over water at all. An inspection by town surveyors showed the house was structurally sound, and flight times from the closest airport did not correlate with disturbances for airplane vibrations to have been a contributing factor. Plumbing inspections showed that there was a slight ground vibration compared with a neighbor's house where no disturbances had occurred, but the vibration levels were not detectable above ground level or within the structure of the home itself. Pratt and Roll conceded that many of the logged incidents could, in theory, have been faked by James or Lucille with the aid of the two children. When Jamie was alone in the room where the occurrences took place, his whereabouts could not always be confirmed by anyone else outside of the family. Some events could have been staged jointly between Jamie and Lucy, or by Jamie alone, although there was no evidence of this happening. It may have been possible, the scientists felt, but not probable. In their opinion, the more difficult to account for incidents were the occurrences that were observed by a third person when neither child was in contact with the object or in the vicinity. Although these two could have been carried out by, quote, an audacious trickster, assuming that the third person had been distracted. They argued that none of these objections apply to 17 of the incidents in which the position of the children was known to some other person to be such that they definitely could not have thrown, pushed, or similarly upset the object in question. They noted that Jamie was harshly grilled by both his father and Detective Tozzi on several occasions, but stood firm in denying it had anything to do with him throughout the entire period of the disturbances. Jamie was grilled by the detective and his father to the point of crying and stress, yet never faltered in his account. Neither Jamie nor Lucy were troubled children who misbehaved or caused issue within the family. They had never pulled any sorts of pranks before and were described as quiet and bookish children. Pratt and Roll argued that the idea that the series of disturbances was a story invented by the family would not account for incidents witnessed by non-family members, and raises the question of why the family would have involved the police. They further note that the two reporters who witnessed incidents and who appeared to them to be cautious and alert observers were also skeptical about parapsychology interpretation. Well, they were apparently convinced, and that no other person involved with the case unearthed anything suspicious. After Pratt and Roll investigated the case, they wrote to encourage the family to sit for lie detector tests, arguing that this would be in their best interests and would also help the investigation. The suggestion was declined by the parents, though, because apparently they didn't want to subject their children to it, and James Sr. was not convinced as to the accuracy and reliability of the tests. Let's talk about psychokinesis. The investigators' favoured explanation was what they termed as recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK. They believed it was caused unintentionally and unknowingly by young Jamie. RSPK is a hypothesized repressed psychological force that expresses itself in the unconscious performance of violent physical acts. This is supported by the incidents focused mainly on 12-year-old Jamie and the pattern of incidents suggested motivation on his part, but difficult to interpret in terms of trickery. Elaborating on this in a 2003 paper, Dr. Roll observes that most of the disturbed objects belong to the parents or happened in their spaces, and that psychological studies showed that Jamie had strong feelings of anger toward his father. Roll suggested that the fact that the bottles were mostly of products used by Mrs. Herman further indicated that the boy had unmet dependency needs. Roll also noted that measurements showed a decline in the number of movements correlating with distance from Jamie, an effect that he found in other similar cases, three of which he himself had investigated. For Roll, this supports a proposal by parapsychologist William Joynes that RSPK manifests in the form of waves, producing a decline in effect due to distance. Roll also notes a theory proposed by parapsychologist Harold Puthoff that an object may be freed from gravity or inertia if the RSPK agent affects the universal proliferation of random electromagnetic fluctuations. This is known as zero-point energy, or ZPE. It's also worth noting here that Dr. Puthoff is considered as one of the leading researchers and experts into extraterrestrial energy and vehicular science, and has spent a number of decades involved in the United States government research into UAPs. If PK waves convert to some other kind of energy while penetrating the zero-point energy, kind of like sunlight converting to heat as it passes through water, the PSI wave energy could convert to kinetic energy, causing objects freed from gravity or inertia to move seemingly independently. Roll also suggested testing for the involvement of electromagnetism and the quantum mechanical concept of observer participation. The term PSI is used in parapsychology to describe phenomena that appears to involve information or energy transfers outside of known physical or biological processes or forces. Skeptic ghost hunter Joe Nickel expands on the trickery theme in his 2012 book, quote, The Science of Ghosts, having obtained access to the 60-page police file. He notes that the events mostly happened when young Jamie was nearby, either in the house or in another location, and that nothing occurred when he was away, although this isn't entirely accurate. Nickel also observes that the perpetrator appeared keen to avoid being observed. For instance, the objects that detectives dusted with a powder that would later show up under ultraviolet light were not disturbed. He further claims that witnesses might have been mistaken or distracted, and that his analysis of each movement of objects suggests in each case simple trickery such as a boy could affect. This, in his view, would mean that a 12-year-old boy pulled the wool over the eyes of his parents, sister, several police officers, journalists, scientists, and independent investigators. Something in which he himself concedes is extremely unlikely. The Seaford poltergeist incident is the most discussed and documented poltergeist case of the 20th century, even though it seems as if it's hardly mentioned today. But it was publicized in countless newspaper stories, radio and television broadcasts, innumerable magazine articles in many different languages, several books, documentaries, and scientific journals. The publicity of this case led to renewed interest in such cases among parapsychologists. The case also bore similar characteristics to the Enfield poltergeist incidents in 1970s England. Both Pratt and Rawl investigated a similar reported phenomenon in 1971, in which souvenir objects appeared to propel themselves off shelves in a Miami warehouse. And Rawl was also present in a widely publicized case in Columbus, Ohio in 1984. You will likely know this as the Tina Resch case of Columbus. But what are your thoughts on this case? I personally find poltergeist accounts absolutely fascinating, and it's interesting that there is a genuine scientific field of research into the phenomenon, and one which cannot explain it with any certainty. Do you think sinister spirits or demons are behind the occurrences? Or do you support the theory that psychological phenomenon results in the incidents documented here and in other well-known cases? Psychokinesis triggering zero-point inertia is an extremely fascinating concept, and the evidence to support this theory, although in its infancy, certainly does lead us down an interesting path of possibilities. A reporter named W.M. Michaelfelder wrote a wonderfully scaremongering and somewhat amusing article for the local Seaford Telegram in 1958. Michaelfelder perceived the cause of the disturbances at the Herman home were caused by the history of the land. He wrote, quote,
Seaford has emerged as the dead center of the occult jumpings of Chief Takapusha and his devil-worshipping Massapequas back in the 1680s. Historians have recalled how in the Seaford area, including the very neighborhood the Hermans lived, Indians led by Takapusha held fantastic religious rites in the forest. Heard through the shadows of the trees within the Puritan settlements were dark vibrations and unearthly drumbeats. These drumbeats sent a shiver into the heart of every white man for miles. Finally, the Puritans sent out armed men to warn the Indians to stop their powwow and worship of the devil. Takapusha's tribe lived, fought, and celebrated evil sacred rites in the Nassau County area and were an offshoot of the famed Algonquins who lived in a devil-worshipping, drum-rolling village.
Dead Souls is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and Coag. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at Dead Soulscast and Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. If you want to support the show, You can do so by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters, and exclusive access to written articles, blogs, and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often, our podcasts get age-restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm-friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered, and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research, and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. patreon.com/deadsouls. That's it. Thank you for listening. Good night, everyone.